helmet. That depends on your mood, adjunct. She climbed to her feet and strode to check her horses.
You're getting stranger every day, Tool, she said quietly, more to herself than to the IMAS.
Into her mind returned the first thing she had seen when she opened her eyes. That damned creature and his sword. How long had he stood like that? All night? The adjunct paused to test her shoulder tentatively. It was healing quickly. Perhaps the injury had not been as severe as she had first thought. As she saddled her horse, she chanced to glance at Tool. The warrior stood staring at her. What kind of thoughts would occupy someone who had lived through 300,000 years? Or did the IMAS live? Before meeting Tool, she had generally thought of them as undead, hence without a soul, the flesh alone animated by some external force. But now she wasn't so sure.
Tell me, Tool, what dominates your thoughts?
The IMAS shrugged before replying.
I think of futility, adjunct.
Do all IMAS think about futility?
No, few think at all.
Why is that?
The IMAS leaned his head to one side and regarded her.
Because, adjunct, it is futile.
Let's get going, Tool. We're wasting time.
Yes, adjunct.
She climbed into the saddle, wondering how the IMAS had meant that. Book 4. Assassins. I dreamed a coin with shifting face. So many youthful visages, so many costly dreams. And it rolled and rang round the gilded rim of a chalice made for gems. Life of Dreams, Ilbaris the Hag. Chapter 11. The night held close as I wandered, my spirit unfooted to either earth or stone, unraveled from tree, undriven by iron nail. But like the night itself, a thing of air, stripped of light. So I came upon them, those masons who cut and carved stone in the night, sighting by stars and battered hand. What of the sun? Asked I of them. Is not its cloak of revelation the warmth of reason in your shaping? And one among them answered, No soul can withstand the sun's bones of light, and reason dims when darkness falls. So we shape barrows in the night for you and your kin. Forgive my interruption, then, said I. The dead never interrupt, said the mason. They but arrive. Pauper's Stone, Darujistan.
Yet another night, yet another dream, Crupper moaned, with naught but a scant fire to keep this wanderer company.
He held his hands over the flickering, undying hearth that had been stoked by an elder god. It seemed an odd gift, but he sensed a significance to it.
Crupper would understand this meaning, for rare and unwelcome is this frustration.
The landscape around him was barren. Even the ploughed earth was gone, with no sign of habitation in sight. He squatted by the lone fire in a tundra wasteland, and the air had the breath of rotting ice. To the north and to the east, the horizon gleamed green, almost luminescent, though no moon had risen to challenge the stars. Crupper had never before seen such a thing, yet it was an image fashioned within his mind.
Disturbing indeed, proclaimed Crupper. Are these visions of instinct then, unfurled in this dream for a purpose? Crupper knows not, and would return to his warm bed this instant, were the choice his.
He stared about at the lichen and moss-covered ground, frowning at the strange bright colours born there. He had heard tales of Red Spire Plain, that land far to the north, beyond the Laderan Plateau. Is this what tundra looked like? He had always pictured a bleak, colourless world.
Yet peruse these stars overhead. They glisten, with a youthful energy, nay, sparkle, as if amused by the one who contemplates them, while the earth itself hints of vast blushes of red, orange, and lavender.
Crupper rose as low thunder reached him from the west. In the distance moved a massive herd of brown-furred beasts. The steam of their breath gusted silver in the air above and behind them as they ran, turning as one this way and that, but ever at a distance. He watched them for some time. When they came closest to him, he saw the reddish streaks in their fur, and their horns sweeping down, then up and out. The land shook with their passage.
"Such is the life in this world," Crupper wonders. "Has he travelled back, then, to the very beginning of things?"
"You have," said a deep voice behind him.
Crupper turned.
"Ah, come to share my fire, of course!"
He saw before him a squat figure, covered in the tanned hides of deer or some such similar animal. Antlers stretched out from a flat skullcap on the man's head, grey and covered in fuzzy skin. Crupper bowed.
"You see before you, Crupper, of Darujistan."
"I am Prankol, of Kanigtol's clan, among the Kroon clan."
Pran stepped close and crouched before the fire.
"I am also the white fox, Crupper, wise in the ways of ice."
He glanced at Crupper and smiled. Pran's face was wide, the bones pronounced between smooth, gold skin. His eyes were barely visible between tight lids, but what Crupper saw of them was a startling amber in color. Pran reached out long, supple hands over the fire.
"Fire is life, and life is fire. The ages of ice passes, Crupper. Long have we lived here, hunting the great herds, gathering to war with the Jaghut in the Southlands, birthing and dying with the ebb and flow of the frozen rivers."
"Crupper has travelled far, then?"
"To the beginning and to the end. My kind give way to your kind, Crupper, though the wars do not cease. What we shall give to you is freedom from such wars. The Jaghut dwindle, ever retreat into forbidding places. The Fokrul Asael have vanished, though we never found need to fight them. And the Kachin Chamala are no more. The ice spoke to them with words of death."
Pran's gaze swung back to the fire.
"Our hunting has brought death to the great herds, Crupper. We are driven south, and this must not be. We are the Tlan, but soon the gathering comes, and so shall be voiced the right of Aimas and the choosing of the Bone Casters, and then shall come the sundering of flesh, of time itself. With the gathering shall be born the Tlan Aimas and the First Empire."
"Why, Crupper wonders, is he here?"
Prankol shrugged.
"I have come, for I have been called. By whom, I know not. Perhaps it is the same with you."
"But Crupper is dreaming. This is Crupper's dream."
"Then I am honored."
Pran straightened.
"One of your time comes. Perhaps this one possesses the answers we seek."
Crupper followed Pran's gaze to the south. He raised an eyebrow.
"If not mistaken, then Crupper recognizes her as a Rivi."
The woman who approached was perhaps middle-aged, heavy with child. Her dark, round face bore features similar to Pran Cole's, though less pronounced. Fear shone in her eyes, yet there was a grim determination about her as well. She reached the fire and eyed the two men, and most of her attention drawing to Prankol.
"Tlan," she said, "the Tlan Warren of the Aimas of our time, has birthed a child in a confluence of sorceries. Its soul wanders lost, Its flesh is an abomination. A shifting must take place.
She turned to Cropper and swept back the thick woven robe she wore, revealing her swelled stomach. The bare, stretched skin had been recently traced in a tattoo. The image was that of a white-haired fox.
The Elder God walks again, risen from blood, spilled on consecrated stone. Krull came in answer to the child's need, and now aids us in our quest. He apologizes to you, Cropper, for using the world within your dream, but no younger god can influence this place. Somehow you have made your soul immune to them.
The rewards of cynicism, Cropper said, bowing.
The woman smiled.
I understand, Prancol said. You would make of this child, born of Aimar's powers, a soul taken.
Yes, it is the best we can manage, Tlan. A shapeshifter, which we too know as soul taken, must be fashioned.
Cropper cleared his throat.
Excuse, Cropper, please, but are we not missing someone vital to these plans?
She strides two worlds, the Rivi said. Krull guides her now into yours. She is frightened still. It falls to you, Cropper, to welcome her.
Cropper adjusted the sleeves of his faded, threadbare cloak.
This should not prove difficult for one of Cropper's charms.
Perhaps, the Rivi said, frowning. Her flesh is an abomination. You have been warned.
Cropper nodded affably, then looked around.
Will any direction do?
Prancol laughed.
I suggest south, the Rivi said.
He shrugged, and with a bow to the two companions, he headed south. After a few minutes, he glanced back, but the fire was nowhere in sight. He was alone in the chill night. A full moon appeared on the eastern horizon, bathing the land in silver light. Ahead, the tundra rolled on as far as Cropper could see, flat and featureless. Then he squinted. Something had just appeared, still distant, walking with seeming great difficulty. He watched it fall once, then climb back to its feet. Despite the luminescence, the figure looked black. Cropper moved forward. It had yet to see him, and he stopped when he was but 30 feet away. The Rivi had been right. Cropper produced his silk handkerchief and wiped the sweat that had sprung across his brow. The figure had been a woman once, tall, with long black hair. But that woman had been long dead. Her flesh had withered and assumed the hue of dark wood. Perhaps the most horrific aspect of her was her limbs, which had been roughly sewn back onto her body.
"Aye,"
Cropper whispered. This woman had been torn apart once. The woman's head flew up and sightless eyes fixed upon Cropper. She stopped, her mouth opening, but no words coming forth. Surreptitiously, Cropper cast a spell upon himself, then looked at her yet again. He frowned. A spell had been woven about the woman. One of preservation. But something had happened to that spell. Something had reshaped it.
Lass! Cropper barked. I know you can hear me!
He didn't know, but decided to insist in any case.
Your soul is trapped within a body that is not your own. It does not become you. I am named Cropper, and I will lead you to succor. Come!
He spun round and began to walk. A moment later, he heard a shuffling behind him, and smiled.
Ah, he whispered, Cropper has charms indeed. But more, he can be harsh when necessary.
The fire had returned, a beacon before them, and Cropper saw the two figures awaiting them. The vestiges of the spell he had cast upon himself made the Tlan and the Rivi blinding to his eyes. Such was their power. Cropper and the woman arrived. Prancol stepped forward.
Thank you, Cropper.
He studied the woman and nodded slowly.
Yes, I see the effects of the Aimas upon her. But there is more.
He looked to the Rivi,
She was a mage once.
The Rivi moved close to the woman.
Hear me, lost one. Your name is Tattersail. Your sorcery is Thea. The warren flows within you now. It animates you, protects you.
She opened her robe once more.
It is time to bring you back into the world.
Tattersail stepped back in alarm.
Within you is the past, Pran said. My world. You know the present, and the Rivi offers you to the future. In this place, all is merged. The flesh you wear has upon it a spell of preservation, and in your dying act, you opened your warren within the influence of Telan. And now you wander within a mortal's dream. Krappa is the vessel of change. Permit us to aid you.
With a wordless cry, Tattersail staggered into Pran's arms. The Rivi quickly joined them.
My! Krappa breathed. But Krappa's dreams have taken a strange turn. While his own concerns are ever present, a haunting voice, once again, he must set them aside.
Suddenly, Kral stood beside him.
Not so. It is not my way to use you without just recompense.
Krappa looked up at the Elder God.
Krappa asked for nothing. There is a gift in this, and I am glad to be part of its making.
Kral nodded.
Nevertheless, speak to me of your efforts.
Ralik and Murillo seek to right an old wrong, Krappa said with a sigh. They think me ignorant of their schemes, but I shall turn such schemes to my purposes. Guilt rides this decision, but they are needed.
Understood. And the coin bearer?
Protection has been set in motion, though its final shaping is yet to come. I know that the Malazan Empire is present in Darujistan, covertly for the moment. What they seek
is anything but clear, Krappa, even to them. Use this to your advantage when you find them. Allies might come from surprising quarters. I will tell you this. Two now approach the city. One is a Talan Aimas, the other a Bane to magic. Their purposes are destructive, but already forces are in play, attending to them. Seek knowledge of them, but do not openly oppose them. They are dangerous. Power attracts power, Krappa. Leave them to the consequences of their actions.
Krappa nodded.
Krappa is no fool, Kral. He openly opposes no one, and he finds power a thing to be avoided at all costs.
As they spoke, the Rivi woman had taken Tattersail in her arms. Pran Kol squatted nearby, his eyes closed and his lips forming silent words. The Rivi woman rocked the desiccated body in rhythmic motion, chanting softly. Water stained the Rivi's thighs.
Aye, Krappa whispered. She prepares to give birth, in truth.
Abruptly, the Rivi tossed away the body. It crumpled in a lifeless heap. The moon now hung immediately overhead, so bright that Krappa found he could not look at it directly. The Rivi had assumed a squatting position, moving with the rhythm of labor, her face sheathed in sweat. Pran Kol remained immobile, though his body was racked in shivering bouts that twisted his face with pain. His eyes opened wide, glowing bright amber and fixed on the moon.
Elder God, Krappa said quietly, how much will this Tattersail remember of our former life?
Unknown, Kral replied. Soul shifting is a delicate thing. The woman was consumed in a conflagration.
Her soul's first flight was carried on wings of pain and violence. More, she entered another ravaged body, bearing its own traumas. The child that is born will be like no other ever seen. Its life is a mystery, Krappa.
Krappa grunted. Considering her parents, she will indeed be exceptional.
A thought came to him and he frowned.
Krull, what of the first child within the Rivi?
There was none, Krappa. The Rivi woman was prepared in a manner unknown to any man.
He chuckled.
Including myself.
He raised his head.
This sorcery belongs to the moon, Krappa.
They continued watching the labors of birth. To Krappa it seemed they waited more hours in the darkness than any normal night could hold. The moon remained overhead, as if it found its position to its liking, or, he reconsidered, as if it stood guard over them. Then a small cry rose into the still air, and the Rivi lifted in her arms a child furred in silver. Even as Krappa watched, the fur sloughed away. The Rivi turned the child and placed her mouth against its belly. Her jaws bunched, and the remaining length of umbilical cord fell away. Prankul strode to stand beside Krappa and the elder god. The Talan looked exhausted.
The child drew from me power beyond my control, he said softly.
As the Rivi squatted again in afterbirth, holding the child against her chest, Krappa's eyes widened. The mother's belly was smooth. The white fox tattoo was gone.
I am saddened, Pran said, that I may not return in 20 years to see the woman this child shall become.
You shall, Krull said in a low tone. But not as a Talan. As a Talan I mass Bonecaster.
The breath hissed between Pran's teeth.
How long? He asked.
300,000 years, Prankul of Kaniktol's clan.
Krappa laid a hand on Pran's arm.
You've something to look forward to, he said.
The Talan stared at Krappa a moment, then he threw back his head and roared with laughter. The hours before Krappa's dream had proved eventful, beginning with his meeting with Baruch, that permitted the revelation of the coin-bearer, punctuated with the clever, if slightly dramatic suspension, of the coin's wax impression, a cantrip that had gone strangely awry. But soon after the meeting, droplets of now-hardened wax pebbling the breasts and arms of his coat, Krappa paused just outside the alchemist's door. Roald was nowhere to be seen.
Oh my!
Krappa breathed, as he wiped sweat from his forehead.
Why should Master Baruch find Crocus's name familiar? Ah, stupid Krappa! Uncle Mammoth, of course! Oh, dear, that was close. All could well have been lost.
He continued on down the hall to the stairs. For a time there, Opon's power had waxed considerably. Krappa smiled at his pun, but it was a distracted smile. He would do well to avoid such contacts. Power had a habit of triggering his own talents. Already he felt the urgings of the deck of dragons within his head. He hurried down the stairs and crossed the main hall to the doors. Roald was just entering, burdened beneath mundane supplies. Krappa noted the dust covering the old man's clothing.
Dear Roald, you look as if you've just weathered a sandstorm. Do you require Krappa's assistance?
No. Roald grunted. Thank you, Krappa. I can manage. Will you be so kind as to close the doors on your way out?
Of course, kind Roald.
Krappa patted the man's arm and strode out into the courtyard. The gates leading to the street had been left open, and beyond was a swirling cloud of dust.
Ah, yes, the road repairs, Krappa muttered.
A headache had burgeoned behind his eyes, and the bright sun overhead wasn't helping matters any. He was halfway to the gates when he stopped.
The doors! Grupper has forgotten to close the doors!
He spun round and returned to the estate entrance, sighing as the doors closed with a satisfying click. As he turned away a second time, someone shouted in the street beyond. There followed a loud crash, but this latter sound was lost on Grupper. With that bellowed curse, a sorcerous storm roared into his head. He fell to his knees, then his head snapped up, eyes widening.
That, he whispered, was indeed a Malasan curse. Then why does House Shadow's image burn like fire in Cropper's skull? Who now walks the streets of Jerujistan?
A count of knots unending.
Mystery solved! More mysteries created!
The pain had passed. Cropper climbed to his feet and brushed the dust from his clothing.
Good that said affliction occurred beyond the eyes of suspicious beings, Cropper notes with relief. All upon a promise meant to friend Roald. Wise old friend Roald. Upon's breath is this time welcome, though begrudgingly so.
He strode to the gates and peered into the street. A cart filled with shattered cobbles had toppled. Two men argued incessantly as to whose fault it was, while they righted the cart and proceeded to refill it. Cropper studied them. They spoke well the Daru tongue, but to one who listened carefully, there was the hint of an accent that did not belong.
Oh, my,
Cropper said, stepping back. He adjusted his coat, took a deep breath, then opened the gate and walked into the street. The fat little man with the flopping sleeves walked from the house's gate and turned left. He seemed in a hurry. Sergeant Whiskey Jack wiped the sweat from his brow with a scarred forearm, his eyes slits against the bright sunlight.
That is the one, Sergeant,
Story said beside him.
Are you sure?
Yes, I'm sure.
Whiskey Jack watched the man winding through the crowd.
What's so important about him? He asked.
I admit, Sorry replied, to some uncertainty as to his significance. But he is vital, Sergeant.
Whiskey Jack chewed his lip, then turned to the wagon bed where a city map had been laid flat, its corners anchored down by chunks of rock.
Who lives in that estate?
A man named Baruch, Sorry answered. An alchemist.
He scowled.
How did she know that?
Are you saying that fat little man is this Baruch?
No. He works for the alchemist. Not a servant. A spy, perhaps. His skills involve thievery, and he possesses talent.
Whiskey Jack looked up.
A seer?
For some reason, Sorry winced. The sergeant watched, bemused, as Sorry's face paled.
Damn, he wondered. What on earth is going on with this girl?
I believe so, she said, her voice trembling.
Whiskey Jack straightened.
All right, follow him.
She nodded shakily, then slipped into the crowd. The sergeant rested his back against the wagon's sidewall. His expression soured as he studied his squad. Trotz was swinging his pick as if on a battlefield. Stones flew everywhere. Passers-by ducked and cursed when ducking failed. Hedge and Fiddler crouched behind a wheelbarrow, flinching each time the Bargas pick struck the street. Mallet stood a short distance away, directing pedestrians to the other pavement. He no longer bellowed at the people, having lost his voice arguing with an old man with a donkey, wobbling under an enormous basket of firewood. The bundles now lay scattered across the street, the old man and the donkey nowhere to be seen, providing an effective barrier to wheeled vehicles. All in all, Whiskey Jack concluded, everyone with him had assumed the role of heat-crazed street worker with a facility he found oddly disturbing. Hedge and Fiddler had acquired the wagon, loaded down with cobbles, less than an hour after their midnight landing at a public dock on the lakefront. Exactly how this had been accomplished, Whiskey Jack was afraid to ask, but it suited their plans perfectly. Something nagged at the back of Whiskey Jack's mind, but he dismissed it. He was a soldier, and a soldier followed orders. When the time came, there would be chaos at every major intersection of streets in the city.
"Planting mines ain't gonna be easy," Fiddler had pointed out. "So we do it right in front of everyone's nose. Road repair."
Whiskey Jack shook his head. True to Fiddler's prediction, no one had yet questioned them. They continued ripping up streets and replacing the old cobbles with Maranth munitions encased in fire-hardened clay. Was everything going to be so easy? His thoughts returned to Sorry.
Not likely.
Quick Ben and Kalam had at last convinced him that their half of the mission was better off without her. She had tagged along with his crew, eyes never still, but otherwise offering little in the way of assistance. He admitted to feeling some relief that he'd sent her off on that fat man's trail. But what had pulled a 17-year-old girl into the world of war? He couldn't understand it. He couldn't get past her youthfulness, couldn't see beyond to the cold, murderous killer behind those dead eyes. As much as he told his squad that she was as human as any of them, the doubts grew with every question about her that he could not answer. He knew almost nothing about her. The revelation that she could manage a fishing boat had come from seemingly nowhere. And here in Darujistan, she'd hardly acted like a girl raised in a fishing village. There was a natural poise about her, a measure of assurance more common to the higher, educated classes. No matter where she was, she carried herself as if she belonged there. Did that sound like a 17-year-old girl? No, but it seemed to match Quick Ben's assertions, and that galled him. How else to match her with that icy-cold woman torturing prisoners outside Nathilog? He could look at her and part of him would say, "Young, not displeasing to the eye, a confidence that makes her magnetic." While another part of his mind snapped shut. Young. He'd hear his own harsh, pained laugh. Oh no, not this lass. She's old. She walked under a blood-red moon in the dawn of time, did this one. Her face is the face of all that cannot be fathomed, he thought. And she's looking you in the eye, Whiskey Jack, and you'll never know what she's thinking. He could feel sweat drain down his face and neck. Nonsense. That part of his mind lost itself to its own terror. It took the unknown and fashioned, in blind desperation, a visage it could recognize. Despair, he told himself, always demands a direction, a focus. Find the direction, and the despair goes away. Of course, it wasn't that easy. The despair he felt had no shape. It was not just Sorry, not just this endless war, not even the treachery from within the Empire. He had nowhere to look for answers, and he was tired of asking questions. When he had looked upon Sorry at Grey Dog, the source of his horror lay in the unveiling of what he was becoming. A killer stripped of remorse, armored in the cold iron of inhumanity. Freed from the necessity to ask questions, to seek answers, to fashion a reasonable life like an island in a sea of slaughter. In the empty eyes of this child, he had seen the withering of his own soul. The reflection had been unblemished, with no imperfections to challenge the truth of what he saw. The sweat running down his back beneath the jerkin felt hot against the chill that gripped him. Whiskey Jack lifted a trembling hand to his forehead. In the days and nights ahead, people would die by his command. He'd been thinking of that as the fruition of his careful, precise planning. Success measured by the ratio of the enemy's dead to his own losses. The city, its busy, jostling multitudes, unceasing in their lives small and large, cowardly and brave, no more than a game board, and a game played solely for the benefit of others. He'd made his plans as if nothing of himself was at stake. And yet, his friends might die. There, he'd finally called them what they were. And the friends of others might die. And sons, daughters, parents. The roll call of shattered lives seemed unending. Whiskey Jack pressed his back against the sidewall in an effort to steady his reeling mind. Desperately, he lifted his gaze from the street. He saw a man at a window on the second floor of the estate. The man was watching them, and his hands were bright red. Shaken, the sergeant looked away. He bit into the side of his mouth until he felt a sharp stab of pain, then tasted blood.
"Concentrate," he told himself. "Step back from that chasm. Concentrate, or you'll die. And not just you, but also your squad. They trust you to get them out of this. You've got to keep earning that trust."
He drew a deep breath through his nostrils, then turned to one side and spat a mouthful of blood. He stared down at the red-slicked cobble.
"There," he hissed. "It's easy to look at, isn't it?"
He heard footsteps and looked up to see Hedge and Fiddler arrive. Both men wore troubled expressions.
"You're right, Sarge?"
Fiddler asked quietly. Behind the two saboteurs, Mallet approached, his gaze calculating and fixed on Whiskey Jack's white, sweat-soaked face. The sergeant grimaced.
"We're behind schedule. How much longer?"
Their faces smeared with white dust and sweat, the two men looked at each other. Then Hedge answered,
3 hours. "We decided on 7 mines, Fiddler said. 4 sparkers, 2 flamers, and 1 cusser.
"Will that bring down some of these buildings?"
Whiskey Jack asked, avoiding Mallet's eyes.
"Sure. No better way to block an intersection."
Fiddler grinned at his companion.
"You got one in particular you want dropped?"
Hedge inquired.
"The estate behind you is an alchemist's."
"Right," Hedge said. "That should light the sky all right."
"You've got 2.5 hours, Whiskey Jack said. "Then it's on to the Majesty Hill crossroads."
Mallet stepped close.
"Another headache?"
he asked softly. Whiskey Jack closed his eyes, then gave a sharp nod. The healer raised a hand and passed it over the sergeant's brow.
"Just easing it a little," he said.
The sergeant grinned ruefully.
"This is getting old, Mallet. You're even using the same words."
A cool numbness flowed through his thoughts. Mallet's face was drawn. He lowered his hand.
"When we have time, I'll find the source, Whiskey Jack."
"Right," the sergeant smiled. "When we have time."
"Hope Cal and Quick are doing okay,"
Mallet said, turning to watch the street traffic.
"You sent Sorry off?"
"Yes. We're on our own. They know where to find us, all three of them."
He glanced up at the estate window. The man with the red hands was still there, though now he was studying the distant rooftops. A cloud of dust rose between them, and Whiskey Jack returned his attention to the city map, where every major intersection, the barracks and Majesty Hill, had been circled in red.
"Mallet?" "Sarge?"
"Bit the inside of my cheek again."
The healer stepped close, once more raising his hand. Crocus Younghand strode south on Trallet's Walk. The first signs of the upcoming Gaderon fate had appeared. Dyed banners hung from clotheslines over the street, painted flowers and strips of bark framed doorways, and bushels of dried weeds had been tacked to walls at every crossing. Outlanders already filled the streets. Gadrobi herders, Rivi traders, Catlin weavers. A mob of sweaty, shouting, excited people. Animal smells mixed with human, making the narrower alleys so redolent as to be almost impassable, which in turn crowded the main thoroughfares even more. In past years, Crocus had reveled in the celebration, pushing through the midnight crowds and filling his own pockets by emptying those around him. During the fete, worries of the Malazan Empire's exploits in the far north disappeared for a time. His uncle always smiled at that, saying the turn of the season gave the efforts of humanity their proper perspective.
"The mewling petty acts," he'd say, "of a short-lived and short-sighted species, Crocus, can do nothing to mar the great cycles of life."
As he walked home, Mammoth's words returned to him now. He'd always looked upon his uncle as a wise, if slightly ineffectual, old man. Increasingly, however, he found himself troubled by Mammoth's observations. Celebrating Gedaron's rite of spring, shouldn't be an excuse to avoid the pressures of reality. It wasn't just a harmless escape. It was a means of delaying the probable and making it inevitable. We could dance in the streets all year long, he scowled to himself, to 1,000 great cycles, and with the same certainty reserved for the coming and going of seasons, the Malazan Empire would march through our gates. They'd end the dance with the edge of a sword, being industrious, disciplined people, impatient with useless expenditures of energy, grimly short-sighted. He came to a tenement and, nodding at the pipe-smoking old woman sitting on the steps, went inside. The hallway was empty, the usual crowd of children no doubt outside, playing in the streets, and the calming domestic murmur drifted out from behind closed doors. He climbed the creaking staircase to the first floor. Outside Mamet's door, the scholar's pet winged monkey hovered, scratching and pulling desperately at the latch. It ignored Crocus until he arrived to push it aside. Then it squealed and flew in circles around his head.
Being a pain again, eh?
Crocus said to the creature, waving a hand as it flew too close and ended up snarled in his hair. Tiny, human-like hands gripped his scalp.
All right, Moby,
he said, relenting, and opened the door. Inside, Mamet was preparing herbal tea. Without turning, he asked,
Tea, Crocus? And as for that little monster who's probably riding your head, tell him I've had just about enough of him today.
Moby sniffed indignantly and flapped over to the scholar's desk, where he landed with a belly flop, scattering papers to the floor. He chirped. Sighing, Mamet turned with the tray in his hands, his watery eyes fixed on Crocus.
You look tired, lad.
Crocus slumped into the less ragged of the two chairs occupying the room.
Yes, tired and in a dark mood.
My tea will do its usual wonders, Mamet said, smiling.
Crocus grunted, not looking up.
Maybe, maybe not.
Mamet stepped forward and laid the tray on a small table between the chairs. He sat down with a soft groan.
As you know, I possess few moral qualms about your chosen profession, Crocus, since I question rights of any kind, including ownership. Even privileges demand responsibility, as I've always said, and the privilege of ownership demands that the owner be responsible for protecting his or her claim. My only concern, of course, is for risks you must perforce take.
Mamet leaned forward and poured tea.
Lad, a thief must be sure of one thing, his concentration. Distractions are dangerous.
Crocus glanced up at his uncle.
What have you been writing all these years?
He asked suddenly, gesturing at the desk. Surprised, Mamet picked up his cup and sat back.
Well, a genuine interest in education, then. Finally? As I've said before, Crocus, you possess the intelligence to go so far, and while I'm but a humble man of letters, my word will open to you many doors in the city. Indeed, even the city council is not beyond your reach, if you would choose such a direction. Discipline, lad, the very same requirement you've mastered as a thief.
A crafty expression glittered in Crocus's gaze as it held on Mamet.
How long would it take, he asked quietly, to become known in such circles?
Well, said Mamet, it is the learning that matters, of course.
Of course.
In Crocus's mind, however, there rose the image of a sleeping maiden. Mamet blew on his drink.
With full-time studies and your youthful eagerness, I would hazard a year, perhaps more, perhaps less. Is there a need for haste?
Just youthful eagerness, I suppose. In any case, you haven't answered me yet. What are you writing, Uncle?
Ah.
Mamet glanced at his desk, raising an eyebrow at Moby, who had opened an inkwell and was drinking from it.
The history of Darujistan, he said. I'm just beginning the fifth volume, which opens with the reign of Ektarm, second to last of the tyrant kings.
Crocus blinked.
Who?
Smiling, Mamet sipped his tea.
usurper of Lataste, and succeeded by his daughter Sandine, who brought on the rising time, and with it the end of the age of tyrants.
Oh, right.
Crocus, if you're serious about all this, Darujistan's history is where we'll begin in the lessons. But that doesn't mean starting at Volume 5. It means starting at the very beginning.
Crocus nodded.
Born on a rumor, he said. At the desk, Moby squawked, then coughed. Mammoth shot him a glance, then swung his attention back to Crocus, expression veiled as he replied. Yes, lad. Darujistan was born on a rumor. He hesitated. You've heard that saying elsewhere, recently?
Someone mentioned it, Crocus said casually. Can't recall who, though.
He could, in fact. It had been spoken by the assassin, Ralik Nom. Do you know what it means?
Crocus shook his head.
Mammoth leaned back. Drink your tea, my lad.
The old man paused, then began.
In the early cycles in this realm, three great peoples struggled for dominion, none of them human as we would know human. Bowing out early in the struggle were the Forkral Asale, or the Crusale, as they are now known. Not through weakness, but, well, disinterest. The remaining two peoples warred endlessly. Eventually one fell, for they were a race of individuals battling as much among themselves as against their racial enemies. They were called the Jaghut, though the term has degenerated these days to Jag or Shur. While losers in the war, they did not disappear entirely. It's said some Jaghut survive to this day, though thankfully not on Jennabacus. So, Mammoth cupped his hands around his teacup, Darujistan was born on a rumor. Among the indigenous Gadrobi hill tribes survived the legend that a Jaghut's barrow lay somewhere in the hills. Now, the Jaghut were possessors of great magic, creators of secret warrens and items of power. Over time, the Gadrobi legend made its way beyond the hills, into the Jennabacan north and the Catlin south, to kingdoms since crumbled to dust in the east and west. In any case, searchers came to the hills, at first a trickle, then hordes, entire tribes led by power-hungry shamans and warlocks. Every hillside was laced with trenches and boreholes. From the camps and shanty towns, from the thousands of treasure seekers arriving each spring, a city was born.
Darujistan, Crocus said.
Yes. The barrow was never found, and the rumor has long since dwindled. Few are even aware of it these days, and those who are know better than to resume the search.
Why?
Mammoth frowned. Rarely does a Jaghut construction appear in the hands of a human, but it has happened, and the consequences have inevitably been catastrophic.
The old man's frown deepened.
The lesson is clear for those who would choose to recognize it.
Crocus thought for a time.
So the Crusale vanished, the Jag were defeated. What happened to the third people, then? The ones who won? Why aren't they here instead of us?
Mammoth opened his mouth to reply, then stopped, reconsidering. Crocus's eyes narrowed. He wondered what Mammoth had been about to reveal, and why he had chosen not to reveal it.
Mammoth set down his cup. No one is certain what happened to them, Crocus, or how they became what they are today. They exist, sort of, and are known to all who have faced the Malazan Empire, as the Talan Aimas.
Sorry pushed through the crowd, struggling to keep the fat man within sight. It was not that he was difficult to follow, but the girl was struggling against a storm within her head, which had been triggered by a single word uttered by Sergeant Whiskey Jack. Seer. It had felt as if a dark, compacted thing in her brain had burst open with that word, and now warred against all that surrounded it. Though it had initially come upon her with a force that seemed almost overwhelming, she could now sense its waning. Whatever it fought was winning the battle, yet faintly she thought she could hear the weeping of a child.
I am Cotillion, she heard herself murmur. Patron of assassins, known to all as the Rope of Shadow.
The weeping grew fainter.
The seer is dead. Part of her mind cried out at that, while another asked, What seer? I am within, yet apart. I stand at Shadowthrone's side, and he is named Amonas, and he is the Lord of Shadows. I am here as the Hand of Death.
Sari smiled and nodded to herself, once again in control. Whatever had challenged that was now gone, once more buried deep inside. The luxury of weeping, of anger, of fear did not belong to her, had never belonged to her. She drew a deep breath, and her senses narrowed to the task at hand. The fat little man was dangerous. The how and why of this remained to be answered, but every power hissed in alarm each time she caught a glimpse of him amid the crowds. And all that is dangerous, she told herself, must die. Beneath the second-tier wall in the lakefront, the market along Salt Walk was at its usual frenzied peak. The sour heat, building all day in the cluttered avenues and alleys, was at its height. Sweating, exhausted merchants screamed curses at competitors over the heads of customers. Fights broke out every few minutes in one or another area, the turgid jostle of the crowds pulling the contestants apart long before the arrival of ill-tempered guards. Squatting on their grass mats, local Rivi plainsmen called out in their nasal sing-song endless descriptions of fine horseflesh. At intersections, Gadrobi herders stood at tethering poles, surrounded by braying goats and sheep, while others pushed wooden carts, burdened with cheeses and clay jugs filled with fermented milk. Daru fishermen walked with spears of smoked fish, bobbing above their heads, streaming with buzzing flies. Catelyn weavers sat behind waist-high fortresses, comprised of bolts of brightly dyed cloth. Gredfalan farmers stood in their wagons, selling the season's bitter fruits and sweet tubers. Woodsellers forced their ox-drawn wagons through the crowds, their children clinging to the stacked bundles of wood like monkeys. Dark-robed men and women from Kalos sang out the clashing claims of their thousand sects of Drek, each holding aloft their sect's particular icon. Cropper strode down the market street with a jaunty step, his arms waving about seemingly of their own accord. Such movement, however, was no mere affectation. It disguised the gesturing required for casting spells. As a thief, it appeared that Cropper's tastes did not demand much. He stole food, fruit and sweets mostly, and it was to such desires of the palate that he had honed his skills of magic. As he walked, the chaotic dance of his arms was timed to catch apples flying from baskets, pastries leaping from trays, chocolate-covered cherries plucked from pans, all moving so swiftly as to be no more than blurs dodging bodies in their path. Inside the wide, flopping sleeves of his coat, pockets had been sewn, some large, some tiny. All that entered Cropper's hands disappeared up his sleeves, tucked into appropriately sized pockets. He strode on, a connoisseur of edible delicacies of 100 cultures, an expression of sated contentment on his round face. Eventually, after a long, circuitous route, Cropper arrived at the Phoenix Inn. He paused on the steps and chatted with a lone thug standing there, removing from a sleeve a glazed honey ball. Then, taking a bite from the sweetmeat, he pushed open the door and disappeared inside. Half a block down the street, Sari propped herself against the pitted wall of a tenement and crossed her arms. The fat little man was a wonder. She'd seen enough of his exquisite ballet to recognize him as an adept. Yet she felt confused, for the mind behind the man's facade hinted at capacities far greater than those he had shown. Confirmation that here, indeed, was a dangerous creature. From where she stood, she studied the inn. The man on the steps seemed to be screening everyone entering, but she couldn't detect any gesture that might indicate a thief's cant. The conversations were brief, usually of mutual recognition. Nevertheless, she intended to enter the inn. It was the kind of place Whiskey Jack had sent Kalam and Quickbend to find. a haunt of thieves, strong arms, and assassins. Why the sergeant wanted to find such a place was a detail that hadn't been shared with her. The wizard and Kalam had suspicions about her, and she sensed that their arguments were swaying Whiskey Jack. If they could, they'd keep her out of everything. But she didn't intend that to happen. Pushing herself from the wall, Sori crossed the street and approached the Phoenix Inn. Overhead, the afternoon had waned into a thick, heavy dusk, the smell of rain in the air. As she neared the front steps, the thug's attention focused on her. The man grinned.
"Following Crupper around, eh?" He wagged his head. "Girls shouldn't carry swords anyway. Hope you're not planning to go inside. With the sword, not unescorted anyway."
Sori stepped back. She glanced up and down the street. The nearest pedestrian was over a street away, heading in the opposite direction. She closed her hands around the edges of her half-cloak and drew it around her waist. "Let me pass," she said quietly. How had that fat man spotted her? The man leaned on the railing.
"All this is just begging for some kind of conversation, friendly-like," he said. "So, how about you and me go back to the alley? You lay down your sword, and I'll be gentle. Otherwise, things could get rough. And what would be the fun of—"
Sori's left hand darted out. A dagger flashed between them. The blade entered the man's right eye and then his brain. He jerked back over the rail and fell, landing with a heavy thud beside the steps. Sori walked up to him and retrieved her dagger. She paused, adjusting the belt that carried her dueling sword, then checked the street. Seeing no one close enough to have noticed anything awry in the deepening gloom, she climbed the steps and entered the inn. She was stopped before she had taken her second step, coming face to face with a moaning boy hanging upside down. Two rough-looking women were taking turns to swing him back and forth. Every time he tried to reach up to the rope tied to his feet, he earned a knock on the head. One of the women grinned at Sori. "Hey now," the woman said, grasping Sori's arm as she walked by. Sori turned a cold eye on the woman. "What?" The woman leaned close, her breath a mist of beer as she whispered,
"You get in trouble. You just call for Irilter and Mies. That's us, right?"
"Thank you." Sori resumed her walk. She'd already seen the fat little man. What had the thug called him? Crupper. He'd seated himself at a table near the far wall, beneath the gallery. Through the crowded room, Sori saw a space open at the bar, where she might take position and observe. She pushed forward. Since Crupper evidently knew of her, she decided to make no effort in hiding her attention. Often, that was exactly the kind of pressure that cracked a man's will. In a war of patience, Sori smiled inwardly, the mortal is ever at a disadvantage. Crocus turned the corner and approached the Phoenix Inn. The course Mammoth had set for him was intimidating, the education extending far beyond books, to the etiquette of court manners, the functions of various officials, bloodlines and particular quirks among certain dignitaries. But he had vowed to himself he'd follow it through. His goal was one day to stand before that dull maiden, awaiting a formal introduction. Something in him mocked the image. There stands Crocus, the scholar, the sophisticated young promise, the thief. It was all too absurd, yet it dogged him, steeled his resolve. He'd come to it one day soon. Until then, however, there were other matters to attend to, things that needed redressing. As he came up to the inn steps, he saw a huddled shadow beneath the railing. Cautiously, Crocus moved closer. As Sori reached the bar, the door slammed open on the other side of the room. She turned with everyone else to see a young, black-haired man standing there.
"Someone's murdered Chert!" the man shouted. "He's been knifed!"
Half a dozen patrons surged to the door, pushing past the young man and disappearing outside. Sori faced the bar again. Catching the barman's eye, she said, "Gredfallen ale, please, in a pewter tankard." The woman Irilta had called Mies
appeared beside her, thumping two broad forearms on the bar as she leaned forward.
"Attend the lady, Scurv,"
Meese growled.
"She got taste."
Meese dipped her head close.